Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I'm delighted to welcome Ray Kelly, former police commissioner, and somebody who has, for 50 years, a half a century, devoted his life to, indeed, to law and order. I'd also like, in the interest of disclosure here, to say that Ray Kelly has been a great friend, not only of mine, but of our family and the Irish community for longer than we'd like to go back to. Commissioner Ray Kelly, you're very welcome.
Adrian, thank you very much for those kind remarks, and great to be with you.
Let me ask you, in terms of something new that is a red hot issue, and again the dispute between Apple and the FBI regarding, you know, encryption, and what's your read on that, considering that you have now, you know, you've now become vice chairman of K2 Intelligence. What's your...
Well, no question about it, it's a complex issue, and you can argue, I think, pretty strong positions on both sides. My own position is that at the end of the day, security has to trump privacy. And I believe one approach to this would be for Apple to do what's asked of them with this particular phone. In fact, that's what the FBI is saying. They're only asking for one phone, but I understand that Apple is concerned about a precedent. A judge can construct an order and an environment where that one phone can be examined, and then this issue will have to be pursued in court. People say that it ultimately will be addressed by the Supreme Court, probably. But we really need a piece of legislation. We need Congress to get involved on this. We need the people's representatives to speak about this issue of privacy versus security. This is an immediate issue because, you know, we saw the horrific events that took place in San Bernardino. And I'd like to know, a lot of other people associated with law enforcement would like to know, just what these individuals were concocting, who they were talking to, what sort of information they had. Now, there's a good chance that there is no information on this phone. But the FBI has an obligation to look under every rock to see if there is any information at all. But it is a... it is going to be a big issue as we go forward. Apple says quite openly that they can design a phone and will be designing a phone where they can't penetrate the phone. And
right.
In the new series, we now have 6 and 6S phones. A new phone may be coming out as early as the latter part of this month or later. So It's critical. We don't want our enemies to be able to go dark, as they say. But I think something can be worked out where that one phone can be examined and let the court issues go forward on a separate track.
Let me ask you about your own growing up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. During a time when, in fact, the demographic of the neighborhood would have been Irish and Puerto Rican and Irish. What was that like in terms of either awareness or, you know, the makeup at the time? Were there tensions? Were there... You know, what was that about?
Well, I certainly had a happy childhood, but early on, you know, when I was a young boy, The neighborhood is mainly Irish and Italian people. And then, when I was about 8 years of age, had a large influx of Puerto Rican people. And there was a lot of tension that resulted almost immediately after that. The Irish young people thought they had an obligation to protect their turf. And so we had a lot of battles, if you will.
Yeah.
And in those days, we had a lot of longshoremen who lived in the neighborhood.
Tough
individuals. In any event, I tell in my book, the book is Vigilance, so I talk about a story that sort of gives you a little insight into the environment in those days. Mrs. Doherty, a mother in the neighborhood, actually made a ring with other people so that I could fight a young Puerto Rican boy. You know, much different than the helicopter parents that you see these days. Yeah. But so that was sort of the environment.
Yeah.
My father, I was the youngest of five, and my father saw me sort of drifting towards the gangs, which were, you were being sort of divided into gangs in those days. And as a result, we moved to Queens.
Yes.
And when I was a teenager. And, you know, I think things were fine in Queens, too, in Woodside, Sunnyside.
Yes.
Great neighborhood. Certainly a great neighborhood these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Your draw, the magnet which brought you into the field of law and order, the police academy, you were kind of on your own in the family with that one. Your brother Don, you know, who we know very well and who ran Immigrant Savings Bank, there was a tendency, one would say, from from the Irish areas anyway, at that time, the security of, you know, the telephone company and Con Edison and whatever. There had been, of course, a great history of the police and the police department going back a long time. But were you encouraged to look towards the police department? Where did that come from?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't particularly encouraged at all. I was going to Manhattan College. My mother was working in Macy's in a part-time job, and I started working there in high school. I needed to work to pay the tuition, and I started working there in high school and my first year of college, so that I'd be able to pay my tuition. And I saw an advertisement for police cadet program. It was an effort to get college graduates, matriculating college students, into law enforcement. It actually was the brainchild of someone called Adam Walensky, who was a Kennedy protege. Yeah. So the NYPD started it. I was in the first class, and it was a very good part-time job, and I was there with other college students, working in the communications division. And I found that fascinating. It was sort of the hub of the city. Information was coming in from all over. You felt like you were really engaged. And I really sort of, became fascinated by that function and ultimately the rest of law enforcement. However, I had three older brothers, Don, Jim, and Ken, who were all in the Marine Corps. So I was going to go in the Marine Corps. I had no choice. So when I was in Manhattan College, I joined the officer training program.
Yes.
And a unique thing happened. I graduated from college, got a commission in the Marine Corps, but because I was a police cadet, I had met all the requirements, and I was appointed as a police officer before I had to go on active duty in the Marine Corps. So I was only on for a few days, and then I went in the Marine Corps, went to Vietnam, and that sort of thing. And I came back to New York after my active duty time in Vietnam, and I had this job in the police department waiting for me because I had joined before. And I wanted to go to law school, and I thought that the police department would be a good vehicle to do that. Some people had done that before. You had to work around the clock. It was demanding. But you could rotate some of your hours to be able to go to law school. And that's what I did. When I was in law school, I got promoted to sergeant. And it's like a velvet trap. I found it so exciting, so invigorating. And really, opportunity to make a difference, to affect people's lives. So I just became fascinated with policing, and really I enjoyed every minute of it. It was some you enjoy less than others, of course, but it was a great experience. I was in 25 different commands in the department, and ultimately I was the first deputy commissioner. I was police commissioner twice. It was a great honor.
Let me ask you, having served two terms as police commissioner in New York, had New York changed itself, not the job, but had the environment changed by the time you were selected by, Mayor Bloomberg? You had already done your stint with Mayor Dinkins. What was the profile, and what was the new job as police commissioner versus, you know, that 10 years in between, when you had gone on and stayed in law enforcement, but gone on to the federal level? What was the city like? Was there something very different about the city that you...
Yeah, the thing that was different was that Mayor Bloomberg was elected 56 days after the horrific events of September 11th. So that was a game changer, and we had to respond to that, we being the Bloomberg administration. We wanted to both supplement what the federal government was doing, and also do things in a symbolic fashion, because after 9/11, there was an awful lot of gloom and doom. People thought the city was falling apart. So we knew that we wanted to not rely totally on the federal government to protect New York. I had been the police commissioner in 1993, when the first World Trade Center attack took place. And I think we being the nation, we just simply were not taking care of business the way we should have in 1993. And, of course, we had the attacks of September 11th. So we were a city that was attacked successfully twice by terrorists. And we wanted to do something that would better protect the city. So we did several things. We started the Counterterrorism Bureau, the first of its kind in the country. We brought in experts from the federal government, intelligence experts, David Cohn, Frank Labuti, a Marine Lieutenant General, many analysts from Washington and from the top educational institutions in the country. We ultimately devoted over 1,000 police officers to counterterrorism efforts, because we knew that New York was the number one target in this country and indoors to this day as the number one target, even though, yes, we've seen the terrible events in San Bernardino and obviously the Paris attacks that really shook the world. But we made a lot of changes, and we recruited widely. We expanded our recruiting efforts to a point where the police department now has police officers born in 106 countries. Gives the department tremendous language capability, flexibility to do investigations, because we speak the same language, that sort of thing. But yes, to answer your question, the landscape had changed appreciably as a result of September 11th, and because of budget problems, the headcount of the department was being reduced. Ultimately, it was 6,000 fewer police officers in the NYPD than in the previous administration. So we had a lot of things to juggle. We had to also, of course, focus on conventional crime. Mayor Giuliani had done a good job in addressing crime, and, people were saying, hey, how can Michael Bloomberg, who comes from a business background, do this sort of work? So we had to focus on conventional crime as well. Plus, there were clearly some issues as far as diversity is concerned and tension in certain neighborhoods throughout New York City. We had to address all of these things. So I say we put in a regimen that really involved the three C's: counterterrorism, crime suppression, and community relations. And that was our mantra going forward.
The development of community relations, that had a different twist to it by the time you came in. There was, and again, you've mentioned, Mayor Giuliani had done a very good job, but morale and community relations had really kind of depreciated somewhat in what was a good job to do.
I wouldn't say. In terms of in the previous administration.
Yes.
I think the 9/11 events were really a coalescing factor. It brought a lot of people together. I didn't see any morale problems in any big organization. Somebody will always say morale is lower than it's ever been. You know, every year I've been in the department, somebody said that. You know,
I know
that's what happened. You know.
Yeah, morale in the community, though, of their relationship with the police department had to, basically had to be rebuilt, because now there are two new things happening, and not the least of which is the tremendous fear, instability brought on, by 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
But there were fences to be mended with the community. Couple that with the, with real fear for real reasons, that was something you had to, adjust very quickly in order to leave people. You could add to that one, you had a mayor who says, go do what you have been doing, don't give in to, your fears, this place is fine. At the end of the day, though, that's your job as police commissioner to make sure that people do feel somewhat safer.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of issues that we had to address. As far as community relations are concerned, I did a lot of outreach. I went to many groups throughout the city, community council meetings, that sort of thing. We still had some of the spillover from the Amadou Diallo incident, and the Dorisman was another incident that caused certainly community relations issues for the department. So these are things that had to be addressed, had to be certainly high on our agenda. Now, part of the challenge of policing is, because of what we ask police to do, you're always going to have some tension. We ask police like no other city service. We ask them to issue summonses to arrest people. They're authorized to use force, sometimes to use a deadly force. So when you exercise those powers, guess what? Not everybody's happy. So it's always going to be a challenge every day to work on smoothing out those relationships, improving those relationships. People say they do, but they ultimately don't necessarily love police.
Yeah.
What you want is respect. You want mutual respect. Yeah. Community respect the police. Police respect the community. That's really what you're shooting for.
Let me ask you about the issue. Now there's a change in administration. Now there is a campaign coming up, and singularly it appeared that the stop and frisk, which was implemented by Commissioner Ray Kelly, that became a football, as it were. And it was bad enough before the end of the administration, but it became like the singular focal point. And again, obviously, in terms of community relations, that was becoming disastrous.
No, I don't think it was. I think it was overstated. Skillfully slow. So this was a there was a lawsuit started in 1999, and this case continued until the spring of 2013 when it finally went to trial in front of Judge Shira Sinha.
Yes.
Now, I can talk hours about this, and I don't want to bore you with load you up with a lot of statistics, but stop, question, and frisk. The term itself is pejorative. It should be field interrogation or something along those lines. But anyway, that's what we have. This is a practice that stems from the common law, centuries ago. This is what you want your constables, your police officers to do. You see something suspicious, you intervene. You ask that person, why are you acting you're acting? And if you can articulate a fear for your safety, you do a limited pat down. This practice has been validated by the Supreme Court case Terry versus Ohio in 1968.
Yeah.
It is codified. In other words, it's in the law in every state in the union. It's a tool that police officers should have in their toolbox to use naturally. There is an advocacy group that since 1999 has been litigating, or up until 2013 when they ultimately won the case. I thought we did not, we being the city, present a very good a good case. However, the judge finds something called indirect racial profiling is taking place. Nobody ever heard that term before. In the government. Now, I told you that we have police officers from 106 countries. So, in other words, there has to be some sort of concerted effort to engage in racial profiling by police officers from 106 countries. It's most unlikely. The judge herself was removed from the case by the appellate division. Mayor Bloomberg appealed the case to the appellate division. I think partly as a result of slowness on the part of this city about the Bloomberg administration, quite frankly, it didn't make it to court as quickly as it should have.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, when Mayor de Blasio comes in, he decides to end the appeal and imposes, or as a result of that, imposes a monitor to look at this practice. This is a constitutionally approved practice. The stop rate when this case took place was significantly greater in Baltimore, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and Philadelphia than they were in New York. The stops that were recorded amounted to, I think, the highest level of 685,000. That sounds like a big number. It amounts to less than one stop a week per patrol officer, and less than one pat-down every 2 weeks per patrol officer. Yeah, everything is bigger in New York. You have to put it
yes.
in perspective. We had evidence. We had a RAND Corporation study that said what racial profiling should look like. How do you determine that it's taking place? We couldn't get that evidence into court. So who's losing out? I think the citizens are losing out to the extent that's been restricted. What we pushed was accurate reporting. Clearly, the statistics did not show the amount of stops taking place prior to us requiring police officers to make out records. It looks like a big number. It wasn't a big number. And it's a serious question to never answer. How do you do racial profiling in a particular precinct area that's all pretty much of one race?
Absolutely.
So it is. It's an issue that I think the public will suffer for the fact that it's been reduced, and it is being used effectively in other parts of the country. This is just a district court case that really has no import anywhere else in the country.
You took exception to, as of course a lot of people did in the city, with the presentation of of supposed facts that were actually fit into more public relations than reality. The fact that one could say that there's a new each administration brings a new accounting system, but in this particular instance, I think that most people felt that the figures pertaining to security and law enforcement and everything were being fudged in the sense that we weren't getting the true story, and particularly in comparison to, you know, to the previous administration.
Well, I made a statement saying that I was being told that the shooting numbers are not accurate. Now, shootings are not crimes, believe it or not. They have to be an assault or something, a different definition, but I've been measuring shootings. So I made that statement. I stand by that statement. But even more important than numbers is the perception. And this city, if you stop people on the street and ask them, is sliding back to the way it was as far as quality of life is concerned. You see a lot more homeless on the streets. You see petty violations taking place. You see this administration moving to take them out of sort of criminal court processes and make them minor civil offenses. I mean, I think that's the wrong move because people are complaining about quality of life conditions, and yet this is another signal that they're being weakened. So perception, certainly in New York, is oftentimes reality. And the perception these days that things are sliding.
Yeah. But also, it's, you know, we had a situation where New York City Council has felt that in the interest, you know, of lightening up, so to speak, you know, urination on the street, the turnstiles, the subway, the totally unacceptable, quality of life issues for the rest of us.
Yeah.
It would appear that there is actually, we shouldn't be surprised that the city is slipping backwards. If in fact you're going to take issues that common sense would say, well, that's, can't put up with that, and purposely, roll those out as supposedly a favor, to our community. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. It's a very bad signal to give because that's what people respond to. I mean, we're trying to deter or prevent that sort of human behavior. If you give signals that the penalty is being lessened, it's only natural that people who are prone to engage in this sort of activity will increase it. This is logical.
Absolutely.
So I don't know why they did it. They did it, obviously, at the end of the day for some sort of perceived political benefit. I don't know what constituency really, at the end of the day, supports that kind of activity, but they obviously did. I thought it was interesting that nobody was willing to respond to it in terms of press inquiries, either from the police department, the district attorney's office, or the mayor's office. So I don't know what that means.
Okay. Well, it'll have to go.
I'm not too proud of it.
Yeah. Now, we know you, and particularly in New York, as a very effective police commissioner. But when it came time for you to actually document your life and your career in law enforcement, you had a lot more to talk about, in terms of your engagement at the federal level. There were so many areas there. Mm-hmm. Brought you back, of course, to the Empire City, and it brought you back. But your book, book which is doing extremely well, Vigilance, My Life Serving America and Protecting Its Empire City. The book itself kind of brings us right through your career, and it for once and for all shows that the isolation, and many people would be very happy as a police commissioner, but you are brought to to the federal level and to the international level, and just it's mind-boggling to think of how police departments around the world, come from is a creation of your reign in New York City. How did you manage to go to the federal level, to go to positions that were at least very, very tough? Customs, the protection that we don't take, that pretty much we take it for granted.
Yeah.
How did that evolve?
Well, when I left being a police commissioner the first time under David Dinkins, I was asked fairly early on to go to Haiti by the federal government and be in charge of something called the police monitors. If you recall,
yes.
President Aristide had been ejected from the country. U.S. was committed to getting him back in place. There was a skirmish in terms of a Navy ship not being allowed to unload in Haiti. So it really came to a head. The U.S. Army ultimately intervened, but they didn't want to be the police of Haiti. So they asked me to manage, to run an entity called the International Police Monitors. It consisted of police from 20 countries who spoke 6 languages, interpreters, U.S. Army and Marine Corps personnel, a total of 1,300 troops. So I was the CEO, if you will, of that entity. It was a great experience. I had a lot of great adventures in Haiti, and the Haitian people were very impressive to me. Shortly after that, I was with the security firm. I was asked by then Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, to come to Washington and be the Undersecretary for Enforcement. At that time, about 40% of federal law enforcement was in the Treasury Department, Secret Service, U.S. Customs, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, all of the federal training of their agents was done under that umbrella. So I did that. I went there, and I enjoyed that job. I was working fairly closely with the White House in those days. And then there came a time where there was an opening, the Customs Commission, which had reported to me, and I did sort of an un-Washington thing. I sort of demoted myself and took that job. I wanted that experience, 20,000 employees, over 400 ports of entry. And they had some significant issues as far as search and seizure, which I had some experiences after that. So I became U.S. Customs Commissioner. After the end of the Clinton administration, I went to Bear Stearns, and then Mike Bloomberg asked me to join him as a police commissioner a second time. And that was another great experience in 12 years. So, I can't say I had a master plan. These things just sort of appeared, and I reacted to them, and I have really very few regrets.
When and your book is extremely well reviewed, there are many people that we know. The reaction to the book is boy, that's scary stuff in there, in terms of perhaps something that we were not privy to, and that is the outer attacks and the outer plannings of from several countries and from several groups who after 9/11 not only continued but kept coming up with elaborate ways to attack us. Now, I don't know what we were doing during that period of time after 9/11, but we always heard about, how an attack was thwarted, that you know, we really didn't have any idea of how close we came to actually being back to, you know, the devastation of 9/11.
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon because the 16 plots that I talk about in the book, they were all thwarted, but some were just prevented, or just, some just didn't happen as a result of good luck. Faisal Shahzad is an individual who drove into Times Square May 1st, 2010, tried to detonate a major bomb, and it fizzled. But we didn't know anything about him. We were not looking at him. It wasn't on anybody's radar screen. So it fizzled because he used the wrong ingredients. He sort of dumbed them down because he was concerned that he would be stopped when he was accumulating material to do it. So there's a lot of interesting stories, I believe, in the book. But your point, I think, is well taken in that when these stories are reported, they are a story for a day or a day and a half. Mm-hmm. And then the public forgets about it. Forgets about the sort of the cloud of danger or
a greater
threat
danger, yeah.
that sort of lays over this city and other cities.
Yeah, but we were also inclined to go on the same assumption that we had before 9/11 and say, okay, well now, yeah, well we're safe here anyway. We're the largest power in the world. 9/11 comes and we have to say, well, okay, we learned a lesson from that. That's never going to happen again. And the reality of the matter is that things, you know, in terms of threats, if anything, we're under more severe threat than we were, you know, at 9/11. And that's not supposed to make any of us feel better, but the point about it is that the surveillance that, you know, see something, say something, that all of that is doesn't have a time frame, but it doesn't look like, well, give it another couple of years and we're going to be fine.
They are enemies. The terrorists look at the world differently than we do, certainly in terms of a timeline. You know, a lot of the issues that motivate them go back 1,400 years. So the fact that we haven't had a successful attack in this city, and, you know, we could have one tomorrow, or we could have one 3 years from now. Now, the San Bernardino attacks, I think, are a bit of a game changer, because most people assume that if there was a terrorist attack, it would be focused on a big city, someplace where you get media attention, more media attention, that sort of thing. San Bernardino is sort of a working class a town. You wouldn't think of that as a target. But what it shows is that targets of opportunity are really what they're looking for. We can't predict with any certainty where these people are going to become radicalized and then act out. So it's certainly not limited to the big cities anymore. That was the signal or the lesson learned from San Bernardino. Everybody has to be vigilant.
Yeah, but also we got used to the idea that it would take a tremendous amount, you know, a great number of people, a clique, you know, a group of people to threaten us, and then take San Bernardino and the fact that the issue now is that, you know, that Apple and the FBI and everybody are digging their heels in and saying, well, that's a bad road to go down. But if you take something as in your face, as these are a couple of people who nobody, I don't care what kind of surveillance you would, how would you pick up on that?
Yep.
And how many more are there?
That's a good point, because we were thinking, certainly after 9/11, immediately after 9/11, that the next attack would be complex, would involve a lot of planning, something that, let's face it, 9/11 attack was, it was ingenious.
Yeah.
What you see is a movement towards much simpler methods of attack. look at the Paris attacks. You basically had four or five attackers.
Right.
The damage that was done in Paris was all done by rifle fire. The bombs that were set off killed the people who were carrying those bombs, the suicide vests. The death took place with AK-47 rifles, the most ubiquitous weapon in the world. There are more AK-47s than any other weapon in the world. A very simple weapon. They killed 130 people in the Bataclan club in Paris. We see that with the San Bernardino people as well. They did their killings with rifles. Rifles that are available in this country.
Yeah.
You know, AR-15 or AF-15, follow-on weapons. So, yeah, it's the simplicity of it. And just as you said, two people can do a tremendous amount of damage.
Does it surprise you that in fact, the term gun control can raise the hairs on the back of the necks of so many people who don't own a gun. They don't,
yep.
You know, they have no interest in owning a gun, but they do think, hey, we have a constitution and this is a right. And despite the tremendous number of attacks, and we see it every day, that it seems like there should be more support, you know, for gun control.
Yeah.
You know, security and police work and the entire security of our nation depends on, you know, it's a hard enough job without fighting within within the United States about something that many would say, well, let's just take another look at it and without challenging the constitutional issue. Let's see if we can, in the interest of not having these horrendous attacks, can we get some kind of a voluntary gesture by those who, you know, by those who have no interest in guns anyway? Rather,
I unfortunately think the answer is no. There's basically two schools of thought in this country about guns. On the East Coast, people will say, well, it's guns that cause the problem, the proliferation of guns, availability of guns.
Yeah.
You go west of here, they'll say, no, it's the people who cause the problem, who get the guns. So, and that division is pretty much represented in Congress, because in Congress, still to this day, gun legislation, gun restriction legislation, is seen as a third rail. They don't want to go near it. They have a blind eye towards it. Now, there are certain common sense regulations that should be put in place, should be easy to come about, but they aren't. Like the gun show loophole. This is something, it's been addressed somewhat by the states, but it needs a federal law. This says that if you and I come together at a gun show, or anyway, that you and I are casual sellers and buyers,
right,
and we can exchange without any background check. Now, I know when I was in the federal government, we found one of these, quote, casual sellers that had 800 guns. So clearly there's violations here. But the federal government will not address this gun show loophole. Now, this is in the late 90s when I was there. We had a report that showed that almost 40% of crime guns were coming through the gun show loophole. Hopefully that's closed down because of what the states have done. But unless you get a uniform national gun control strategy and legislation, you're always going to have a gun problem in this country. 90% of the guns confiscated in New York City come from out of state. New York has the toughest gun laws in the nation. Governor Cuomo saw to that after the Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut. And yet you can go to other states, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, Florida, buy a gun, bring it up here, sell it at a significant profit. So we need a national strategy, national legislation.
Yes.
We're not going to get that anytime soon. The Supreme Court case, District of Columbia versus Heller, found the proposition that the right to have a gun is an individual right, meant that virtually anyone in this country can have a gun. You can put some reasonable rules and regulations in, but it made it a personal right. That's a major hurdle to have to get over.
In writing your book, did you what order did you see? Well, obviously, you gave a lot of thought to it during your during your career. But what order did you? Were there some chapters? Was there a message that you wanted? A singular message that you wanted to get?
Well, I wanted to sort of tell my story. It's done pretty much chronologically. It was also done with an eye towards not doing backbiting or telling tales out of school. When you're in administration, you work for people, there's all sorts of issues that you can put in there. But I don't think it's fair to do that, particularly when an administration is in office. This was done after I was in office. But it certainly was not aimed at a gotcha or get back there in any way. I do point out Mayor de Blasio's false narration when he ran in 2013 that there was a great schism between the African-American community and the police as a result of Stop and Frisk. That simply was not the case. In 2013, we had a 70% approval rating. I had a 75% approval rating. I don't say that to brag. I just said that's an indication of what the relationship was like. They haven't come near those numbers in this new administration. So I do point that out in the book. But other than that, it's an effort to sort of memorialize my life. I think I was blessed with a lot of great experiences and opportunities, as I say. Yeah. I grew up on the west side of Manhattan, had a little adventure there. I was in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, 25 assignments in the police department, police commissioner twice. I was on the Interpol board. I was undersecretary of the Treasury for President Clinton, customs commissioner, director of the international police monitors in Haiti. There's a lot of experiences, and I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned there. Some were learned the hard way. I think it's a pretty good read, and also you can put in a lot of information that's important to me, but the reader's eyes glaze over, So there's a lot of things that I could have put in there, but in order to sort of smooth it out and make it a easy and a quick read, a lot of that was put to the side. Who knows? Maybe there's a book two coming.
Well, on book one, again, my guest, friends, is Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, former police commissioner, but I'd say more people meeting you on the street would say, "Hey, Commissioner," because we think of you very much as being such a part of the fabric of, the after 9/11 that we all know where we were in 9/11, but the aftermath of that.
Yeah.
You had served your time there.
Thank you.
Book is available on Amazon, or indeed you can go to the website, which is www.vigilancethebook.com. An extraordinarily, it's a great book, and I'm delighted that you actually pointed out that it is an easy read, and it's tremendous.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Are you working on book two? Are you working on book two?
I'm thinking about it.
Okay. You don't have to respond to this one, but there are those who say, boy, if we only had Bloomberg as president, and Kelly as mayor of New York, how much greater the place would be. Like I say, you don't have to comment on that one. But I do thank you.
Thank you.
For being with us, and again, your tremendous and effective life that meant so much to so many people.
Thank you.
And continue. You're not retired.
No. Fully engaged. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Good luck. Thank you. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.